Hi, everybody. It's Nick. We are back from the Midwest Gaming Classic, early April 2024 in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, the excellent retro gaming convention up there. It had a huge turnout this year of, I think the last I saw it was about 30,000 attendees, so lots of folks. But all three of us were in attendance from this podcast. That would be myself, Bart, and Connor, who flew from London to be with us. I think that was the first time we were all three together in 2 years. 2 years, yeah. But yeah, we were asked to do a panel or some kind of presentation on the bonus stage on Sunday morning, and it went really well. It was our first ever live show with an in-person audience, so very cool. And we start off here with kind of a short general introduction for people who might be new to homebrew and new to our podcast. Then we go on to interview two different NES developers, John Vanderhoof, with his series of Orebody games, mostly NESmaker, and also Greg Caldwell, one of the guys from Retrotainment Games, a name you may recognize as the developer of Full Quiet, the game we covered in depth on the most recent Game Club episode of this podcast. So yeah, we had a good talk with both these guys about making and publishing and marketing your indie NES games, indie NES games, and both of them have very different histories in the scene, and they come at it from different approaches. And I thought it was a very cool comparison listening to the two of them talk. So yeah, the audio quality was surprisingly really good. We did get a capture directly from the soundboard. Nice. So it's going to sound pretty decent. Please enjoy, and we'll be back soon with our next Game Club episode about Flea and Tapeworm Disco Puzzle for the NES and Dreamcast. Thanks, as always, for listening. All right, this is the Homebrew Game Club, a podcast about modern, brand new, aftermarket indie games for retro consoles. And today we are coming to you live from the 2024 Midwest Gaming Classic in beautiful downtown Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Hello, everybody in our audience. All right. An actual live broadcast. My name is Nick, also known as Divertov, and with me today are...
My name is Bart, also known as Clever, username needed.
And Connor Nash, also known as Connor Nash on most forms of social media.
I had to tell you guys, I think this is our first actual live broadcast, and... I just want to prepare everybody. We are not nearly as funny live. I heavily edit my podcasts, and yeah, we're not as funny or smart live.
Nick is more of a comedy editor than a comedy performer.
Yes. Yeah, we normally, on our podcast, we pick one game a month to play and talk about. We do deep dives on brand new games for old consoles. We get really into the weeds with some of these. But we cover consoles for the NES, the Atari consoles, Sega Dreamcast, Sega Mega Drive. What else? Game Boy?
Game Boy, Commodore 64, even the Spectrum, like the really old ones. And
right.
And you've recently gotten really into Dreamcast and stuff.
Dreamcast.
All the way up to those 120, is that 128-bit? What would you qualify that? That's like it's like post-64-bit. It's like pretty recent technology. So it's the whole gamut, really.
Right. So yeah, we dive into these communities that create these games. Yeah, so we figured today we'd do a little bit of a different approach since this is live and some of you may not be familiar with our podcast. We just kind of generally talk about what is homebrew first. And then we have a couple of homebrew developers out in the audience who are going to come up and answer some questions. So and then at the end, we figured we would open it to questions from the audience. So yeah.
We want to do our first giveaway.
Our first giveaway? All right.
This is a great question.
Who would like a shirt? We got a shirt. Adult medium. Anybody wearing adult medium? You do?
All right.
Let's
to the wonderful man in the front row there.
There we go.
Woo!
Woohoo!
Are you going to give the man a shirt?
He didn't have to do anything for it? Just sit there?
Yeah, just give him
right.
A shirt.
Here's what, it's a quick question. Let's see if we can guess. Can you guess? And you just have to get close. How many episodes do you think we've made of the Homebrew Game Club?
I don't even know that.
That's it. It's a tough question. These are valuable shirts.
Are you talking about numbered episodes?
Do the bonus ones count? No, not for this.
I can't answer that question.
Define it. Give me a number that you think is a reasonable number.
It's too early for this. Just give them the shirt.
Okay.
Close enough.
Yeah. Oh my gosh.
All right.
Here we go.
Woo-hoo.
Now you're wondering, the first thing you're wondering is like, is he really going to give him that shirt off his back? The second question you're wondering is, Does he have another shirt under that again?
We're going to find out.
Let's find
out. This is where the real questions. We like to leave our audience in suspense, if you'll notice on this podcast. It's a lot of fun.
Live broadcast. We're hoping to have this on our podcast feed later, maybe on YouTube, where we can jankily edit it and make it much funnier. But yeah, we did. Let me see what I have. Family Day, do not swear. I wrote that on my hand.
We're trying real hard.
Write that on my hand.
I got to say about 30% of my brain activity is now focused on that particular item.
That's all I'm going to think about for the rest of this broadcast. All right. So what is a homebrew? Let's talk about that. So on this podcast, we have our own working definition of this. So we're talking about new games for old consoles. And what we say when we mean that is completely original games. That's original characters, gameplay, music, even the code for consoles that are no longer being produced or supported by the companies that originally made them. We're not a podcast about hacks. So taking some old game and making some changes to it and putting it online or ports of other games, maybe an arcade game, and taken to another console. That's not what we mean when we say homebrew. Now, those games have artistic merit and we respect them, but that's not what we cover in our podcast. So that's our definition. That's not the only definition of homebrew. For example, if you're on Atari Age and you're in the store on Atari Age, they talk about homebrew. They may be talking about ports of arcade games to the 2600 or the 7800, which is great. But that's not what we're covering. If you're into the Dreamcast, Dreamcast games, Dreamcast developers just call their games indie games. So homebrew is kind of a weird, problematic term. In the beginning, we were fans of the NES, and so that's what we call them homebrew, because that's what they called them in the NES scene when we started out. And also because Retro Indie Game Club does not have quite the same ring to it. So Homebrew Game Club, that's what we do. But yeah, ultimately, these games are indie games. They're indie games that happen to be created within the technical limitations of a particular console. And that's kind of what I find fascinating about them. I don't know about you guys, but it's this idea of creativity within constraints, because a modern game developer, if you had enough time and budget, you could basically make a game about anything. But these are people who are voluntarily deciding to make a game within the constraints of a console that may be 40 or 50 years old. 50 years. 50? God, we're all old. Yeah.
Get off my lawn, indeed.
I just depressed everybody.
It's the get off my lawn game club. Yeah, I mean, the constraints are super interesting to me in terms of how it kind of forces people to make really interesting choices, how it produces creativity in ways that you wouldn't have expected, and honestly kind of gives it a kind of twist on a lot of the kind of things that you would expect. Like, a lot of people would make, for example, games that look retro, and they'll put them in Steam, or they'll make
Shovel Knight,
a modern game engine. But when you are actually constrained to the original hardware, sometimes more interesting things can happen. For example, the size of the games is usually quite small with this, because the original hardware only allows for a specific size of the cartridge, which I kind of like, because it means the games are really focused a lot of the time. They really have like a really clear direction. I don't know about you, Bart, or like what kind of games like you want. You just want huge, rolling, enormous games, but I love the short games. I love the ones that are just like, get them in, little beautiful flavors.
Well, I think, one example I can think of was if you have some developers who, they could make a modern game, but instead they ask the question, what if you could make a really fun four-player game for a console where you can only put 8 sprites on a single horizontal line? Can you make that fun? Oh, and you know what? Can you make the game only 40 kilobytes? That's how, when we say we're talking about small games, that's how small we're talking about. Atari 2600, how 16K? But what were the original? Weren't they like 4K?
4K.
Seriously, 4K. A game. Can you make a game that's fun for a modern audience? It's only 4K, 4 kilobytes, 4,000, right? One frame of your TV screen. Yeah. It's that kind of challenge that we find appealing and that we like to talk about. So yeah, since we started this podcast about 2.5 years ago, and I know I have been just absolutely blown away by the number of games that are out there, but also the quality of the games. So if you haven't looked at one of these scenes in a long time, maybe you kind of dabbled in homebrew, maybe, I don't know, 10 years ago or something like that. If you came back to the NES scene or the Game Boy scene or any of these scenes, I think you would be absolutely blown away at the quality of some of these games. They are as good as, if not better, than the stuff that came out of the licensed eras of these consoles. Yeah. Okay. We're going to give away another t-shirt. All right. Who wears an adult large? Anybody? Anybody wear an adult large? You do?
To the man in the back row.
All right. I don't know if I can throw it that far.
Yeah.
All right.
We got to get one of those t-shirt guns.
Here we go.
Here it is. You see, we tricked you. You thought I was the only one wearing multiple layers.
Guys, I'm
yes.
I'm noticing a pattern here, and I didn't get the two t-shirt memo.
You didn't get the we were talking about it. Come on,
I have one t-shirt on, and yeah, I guess if somebody wants we're just taking off whatever layer Mandalorian on it, yeah.
All right, are we? Do we want to have our first guest on right now? Okay,
yeah, you're the host, man. Make the decision. Let's do it.
Let's go.
We're a little bit unscripted, pseudo scripted. All right, John, you want to come up? Yeah, come
here
on.
He is. Woo!
I'm gonna try to give you a microphone here. That would probably help. All right, you want to try that on?
Welcome to the Homebrew Game Club.
Welcome.
All right. Thank you. Our first guest today is Dr. John Vanderhoff. John is the developer of quite a number of games, many of them for NES, including a series of games set in the Mjolniverse.
That's right.
Right. His most recent game is Crater Song, which just won Best Narrative at yesterday's Nesmaker Bite Off Awards. Please welcome John Vanderhoff.
Hey, guys.
Hey. Welcome.
All right. Okay. So tell me about this Mjolniverse that your games are set in.
Oh man, I can be long-winded about it. Do you want the short version?
No, that's okay, man. We got 50 minutes, 47 minutes to eat up here. So yeah, go
All right.
Ahead.
Well, I'll try to be brief. So there's this really, it's kind of obscure nowadays, but you know, people who know retro games know about it. The game of Mule, which is a sci-fi kind of economic simulator game. Really great for you know, and I played the NES version, which is a kind of like the lesser version in a lot of people's eyes. A lot of people like the Commodore 64 version or something like that. But anyway, I have friends who are obsessed with Mule. And so they introduced me to it like in 2010. I had no real relationship to it. And then Nesmaker, the software, is released in around 2018 after a successful Kickstarter. I've been making games at that point for 2 years within Unity and RPG Maker and other things like that. See, like I said, this is going to get long. But essentially, I had no idea what to do for an NES game. I knew I wanted to make one eventually, but I didn't have like an idea for one. And then we had a Mule tournament, as we did almost yearly, you know, 10 years ago.
A Mule tournament? So like you play the old game, Mule, and you'd have a tournament?
Yeah, it'd be like eight guys who get a bunch of drinks and then stay up all night playing multiple games of Mule. And if you've
played Mule,
that
is the nerdiest thing I've ever heard.
Oh my God, yeah, it is.
I love it.
Yeah, so if you've played Mule, you know that there's a creature in the game called the Wampus, which in the NES version, most versions, is just like a collection of like 3 pixels or something on the screen, and you can choose to hunt it, which is to say like try to touch your character to it at the end of any round to get additional money. It's just something to fill time if you have time left at the end of your round. And I felt sorry for this creature because essentially you're just like bullying it for the entire game. And its sole purpose is just to, you know, kind of shake it loose of its coins that it kind of hoards in its cave. Anyway, to get to answer your question, that's where the idea came from. I wanted to create a game from the perspective of the Wampus, and I realized that is what I could do for my first NES game. And then I kind of, by doing that and learning Nesmaker and learning ASM to a certain extent and learning, you know, just the constraints of the NES, I just kind of fell in love with both NES development, but also the weird narrative possibilities of Mule, which, again, if you've played the game, you know that there isn't really a story there, but there are is a really rich world and characters. So.
Yeah, it's been a long time since I've played it, but yeah, that's what I remember, is this like really rich story, but then the actual game is sort of like a resource management simulator, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's just an economic sci-fi economic simulator, yeah.
Sounds like a party game to me.
Yeah, it's hard to recommend, but I think everyone should check it out.
Right. Well, it definitely sounds interesting how you're able to kind of create a new story out of existing characters in a world that you felt capable of really controlling and having this whole environment to your own disposal. Like, I think that, you know, speaks to what we were saying about the ability to take these constraints and turn it into something that's really unique and that really comes from you. You know, it's a very personally directed idea of like the artwork and the sound and everything kind of is something you have a lot of direct involvement in, which again, contrary to a lot of mainstream games, you might be a bit more other teams involved, whatever. Does this game feel like it's like what percentage of the game is you compared to maybe other people who collaborated with you on it?
I do all the design and some of the pixel work, but I also use a lot of pixel or like assets that I get from like stores, mostly on Itch, and then I edit those. From Wampus and some of those early games, there was a lot more of my own stuff because I was just like coming at it in a very kind of like do-it-yourself way. And then when it comes to basically the one thing I cannot do, and I rely on a very great collaborator, is music. I didn't know Jordan very well. Jordan Davis is a composer on almost all of my NES games. I didn't know him very well when I was doing the first couple NES games. And so it wasn't until the fourth game where I started collaborating with Jordan. And then he's composed the music and sound effects on all of my stuff. So
You mentioned Nestmaker. Just for the people who may not be familiar with what that is, can you explain what Nestmaker is and kind of how it helps you helped you get a leg into developing games?
Absolutely. So Nestmaker is a super accessible, handy, game engine to produce NES games. And while there is a learning curve to it, mostly you can like essentially get something up and running literally within an hour with no experience. Now, that's going to be very rudimentary and based on the code that comes with the tool set. But it's that accessible. Now, to do advanced stuff, to make a full game, to kind of customize it, you do, of course, have to learn, you know, ASM and then the software itself and, you know, pixel art and music and all that stuff. But it's a really great tool. A lot of people know this already, but, you know, it's coming from Joe Granato. And, I'm a big fan of it because it allowed me to do something I never thought was possible. Even when I was making like walking simulator narrative stuff in Unity, I was like, I'll never make an NES game because I just don't have the engineering skills. And it kind of opened up that entire world to me that I'm still trying to get away from. But I've been, I feel like I've been developing NES games for half my life now.
Well, I love that Nestmaker has really kind of lowered the barrier to entry for NES development. And it has helped get a lot of new people into the scene. GB Studio is another sweet software package for Game Boy that has had the same kind of effect. But we were talking about the Bidoff Awards were yesterday in the hall over here. There's a Nestmaker stall over there. But the Bidoff Awards, it's an annual demo that they do, annual contest that they do where people submit demos and then they hand out awards. Yeah, you won the narrative award. So your games are very narrative focused. The ones that I played, they're very text heavy. I mean, you've got a lot of story. There's a lot of backstory. So if you are a narrative game designer and you're working within the particular constraints of the NES, what do you have to kind of take into consideration if you really want to communicate a story through games on that platform?
That's a really great question. And I think there are a couple approaches. Like there's some really great narrative work on the NES that is very, like what you say, my stuff is text heavy. I think it's very front loaded text heavy because I kind of have to crack the story of the game before I get invested in it. Even before I get to the design or the look or the aesthetic or anything, because I come from a place of creative writing. And if I don't understand the stakes and like the world and what's going on, like I don't even get excited about building it. And it's weird, right? On the NES, because of the constraints, like as soon as you start playing the game, the story doesn't matter, right? You can play any of my games and like just ignore that basically. And yet that is the kernel that begins every project. And so to speak to constraints, like some really great, like, you know, RPG or like adventure games on the NES that use a lot of text. And I think that's a great approach. It's weird as a writer to actually want to approach it the opposite way, which is, front load it with text to kind of frame the story. But then to focus a lot on visual storytelling and using mechanics, sort of what you're doing to really tell the story for the rest of the game.
Yeah. And I say text heavy. I meant kind of like in regards to the style of game. I guess I know when I played through Orebody, there was a lot of reading, you know, which is an action platformer. But to get into it, I remember reading. I was like, wow, this is really involved. This is quite a backstory here. But yeah.
Yeah, yeah, that's the writer in me trying to like tell people why this is a cool world beyond just like the pew pew of it, you know?
Yeah. So you've done a lot of different styles of games. You've done like platformers. You've done a shoot 'em up, and then you did Oratorio is a game that you've done that I think is really fascinating. It's a rhythm shooter, and it's not quite anything like I've ever played on the NES. And I know you got Jordan's music going through that. Can you talk about that game a little bit? How did you come up with an idea like that?
Absolutely. I thank you for bringing up that game. Oratorio is currently available on itch, and it's still available physically from Premium Edition Games. But basically, for some people who, like you said, kind of play a lot of different consoles, and I have kind of been playing games since 1985, and one of the best games I've ever played, and I now own it across multiple consoles, it's a game called Rez by Mizuguchi. Basically, the thesis for Oratorio, when I was talking with Jordan, I think at before Bite Off in 2022, was what if Rez, but on the NES? Is this possible? How do you approach this? What are the engineering challenges? What are the challenges for, given the sound constraints and the sound engine we were working with? And then visually, like, how do I accomplish something that kind of speaks to the Rez aesthetic, which is, you know, also the Tron aesthetic some people have compared it to. And so I cracked all those nuts working with Jordan and working with the Nestmaker community, who are amazing and super helpful and generous. Yeah, that was just another one of those. It is a passion project, and I'm super happy with how it turned out. I don't think it's for everyone. And we were able to add Zapper support at the very last minute, which has just kind of opened it up
as
like
cool.
This really cool game for people who appreciate that.
Yeah. That's so interesting, just because, you know, what I'm hearing from you, Rez, if I remember correctly, that was like PlayStation 1?
It was originally Dreamcast, but then PS2. And
PS2,
then, since
okay,
then,
yeah.
It's been ported to a lot of stuff. So.
But yeah, that kind of, I mean, it was, even at the time, regarded as a very creative, very almost like avant-garde kind of game, not really destined for commercial success, perhaps. So not the kind of game that you would see a lot of sequels for, or people still making for these modern consoles. But actually, by looking backwards in some way to the the more retro consoles, and taking that kernel of what the idea is and kind of distilling it down to its core element, you're really able to give it a whole new life. And that's, again, just one of the things that we find really super exciting about the homebrew community. And then the second thing is the community itself, right? What you mentioned just there about working with Jordan, working with people who are in the Nestmaker community, really helping you out, showing you where you can push the system to its limits and do different things. The Zapper is just, you know, so iconic, and to be able to add that back in is just such an awesome thing.
Absolutely, yeah.
So you've done all these different styles of games. What style of game would you maybe like to try that you haven't tried yet?
Well, you mentioned Crater Song earlier, which was a recent kind of bite-off slash, you know, month-long game jam project. And this is a game that is heavily inspired by another awesome indie game that some people have played called Brothers, A Tale of Two Sons, which just recently got a remake. So you can check out a beautiful version of it from 2024. But I played the original on the Xbox 360. And what's really cool about this game is it's a single player, two character game. And so you control one character with on the Xbox with the left joystick and one character with the right joystick. And then there's an interact button for each of the characters. And there's a whole mess of like physics based and environmental puzzles that are built around this. That's the kind of game that I'm doing. That's the new thing. It's for me, it's like an interesting challenge to have that set up on the NES. And the solution was to use two NES controllers held sideways, kind of like Wiimotes or Joy-Cons, so you have access to both digital pads. And then since I've came up with this, people were like, oh, like Smash TV on the NES. And I wasn't aware that you use that, but it makes perfect sense.
Yeah, that's what I think of. I actually taught my son how to use a directional pad by playing Smash TV with him. So he did all the guns, and I did all the movement.
Nice.
So, yeah. What are some of your other favorite homebrew games? For people here who may not be familiar with any of these games, where else, what other games should they play besides yours?
Oh, man, that's like a loaded question, huh?
It's all friendly faces here.
There's
no judgment.
The real question is, like, what don't you name? I would just say, if you're interested in homebrew, like, there's so many awesome games. Like, there's so many lists online. I would just go to different lists and look at them. But personally, since you did ask me, I've been a big fan of like some of these homebrew shooters coming out of Japan. I'm going to forget the Neo Delfino, Justin releases.
Yeah.
But yeah, like Horror Force is really good. Over Object is really, really good. These are just amazing. But I mean, man, so many other good ones. All the stuff that you guys have covered would be on the list, you know?
That's right.
That's right.
His advice is listen to our podcast.
Yes. Everything we cover is gold. That's just the one number one thing to remember.
Story Sword, currently on Kickstarter.
Yes.
Yeah.
Great trailer on that one. We made the trailer, so you should go watch it. Yeah. Any other games? So you've developed, most of your recent games have been for NES. Have you ever considered developing a game for another platform?
Yeah, absolutely. So I came to game development through text adventures on like the PC because I was using like this cool thing called Inform 7. So if you're a big fan of like old school text adventures and don't want to use very useful plugins for Unity or Unreal, there's something called Inform 7. But basically, the next project before Crater Song took over my life was going to be a Game Boy game using GB Studio that you mentioned.
Okay. Yeah.
And that's another... That's another ore body game, and it's called Hammer Mill, and it will come out eventually. And it's a kind of a seafaring, but in this kind of sci-fi, you know, steampunk world of ore body. And the idea is that you are kind of a salvager on the dangerous oceans of this alien planet, and then you befriend like this little creature, has echoes of Mandalorian. And then you kind of try to help this creature reunite with its parents. And yeah, it's narrative, like a lot of my stuff, but going to be for the Game Boy.
Great. Well, I tell you what, we are almost at 10:30 here, so we have another guest we want to bring on. But before we let you go, does anybody in the audience have a question for John Vanderhoff? Yes, sir. What was your favorite workaround for the limitations of the console? Yeah.
That's a really great question, and I guess I would say I really like the solution for Crater Song of using the two controllers. That might, but maybe it's recency bias, but also on Oratorio, I think the idea of like how do you write a soundtrack that can be activated at any time and still sound right, and so that was the work of Jordan composing these really unique compositions that only work in this atmosphere, and also an engineering solution, which is you're working with three sound channels. We were on the NES. One is always playing as a drum, but you need that for the beat. And then the other two are muted at all times, except when the player does something like shoot or hit an enemy or hit a power up. And it was interesting figuring out how to do that. And then using Jordan's compositions, and you'd have to ask him how he comes up with that stuff, but how it just works, right? It's like, I think the use of scales, I don't know, something like that, but just cracking that nut and being like, can I make this concept work? And, you know, I think I did for my own taste, but that's a great question. Yeah.
Does anybody else have any questions for John Vanderhoff? No. John, where can people go to find out more about your work?
Yeah, you can go to itch.io/John Vanderhoff, I think, at John Vanderhoff on X or Twitter. And more importantly, you should probably follow Orebody Universe on Twitter or Twitter or X, whatever you prefer to call it.
Okay, John Vanderhoff, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks, guys.
So we do have another guest who's going to come up, but are we going to do another, you want to do another shirt? You want to do it now or you want to wait?
You don't have a shirt to give?
You want to do the shirt?
Why are you not giving your shirt?
No?
I'm not taking my shirt off.
Come on.
I don't have another one underneath it.
You don't want to?
We're just going to leave these people in
suspense. All right, we got one more shirt to give away here.
Son of a.
What size?
It's a 2X.
2X. Who's wearing a 2X? Anybody?
Yes.
Does anybody just
don't
want
let this guy
shirt?
Get away with that? Don't let him away.
Somebody say yes.
Somebody take this.
Woohoo! Oh. Moving on.
Saved by the bell here. Cannot believe it.
Man, that was going to be my favorite gag. All right. Let me see. Okay, our next guest. I have something in brackets here. It says put together a short intro. All right. You know what? How about we're just going to have him come up here and tell us what all he's done. This is Greg Caldwell from Retrotainment Games. Yeah.
Welcome,
okay. So Jack. I will say, let me see if I can do this off the top of my head. Retrotainment Games. You guys are very busy people. You've made a lot of NES games. You've done Haunted Halloween 85 and 86. Garbage Pail Kids, Mad Mike and the Quest for Stale Gum. And most recent, well, I guess not most recently. Was it Full Quiet most recent?
Yeah, I guess that technically came out after okay. Garbage Pail Kids, even though we started it years before Garbage Pail
okay.
Kids.
Well, so it was the most recent episode of our podcast. We covered Full Quiet. And we do deep dives. We covered that when we talked about that game for 2 solid hours. And we had, you know, as I said, we sometimes critique games. Sometimes we have constructive criticism, you know, and although we do go negative, we don't try to be mean about games or anything like that. But I can't say that when we covered Full Quiet, a couple of our hosts really liked the games. One of the hosts absolutely loved the games. And another one of the hosts did not like the game at all.
I'll just scoot over here.
You know, when that host talked to Mr. Greg yesterday, he was actually very nice and did not get mad at me. So
I want to just echo that a little bit as the host who is perhaps more favorable to Full Quiet. But I think it really just speaks to the community around Homebrew. I think there's a lot of mutual respect among everybody who works and does their, you know, puts their labors of love, as we often say on the podcast, into these things. And I think it's just the nature of, you know, when you're putting things into constraints and you're doing things in a very new and innovative way, you're going to find really interesting ways to do things. But you also find challenges that are sometimes really, really difficult and that doesn't, you know, go with everybody's taste. I don't think that is a negative. I think it's a positive of the scene. I think that's something that actually speaks to how there's so much cross-pollination and so much different ideas that get brought to the fore here. But maybe, I don't know, maybe that leads into my first question, which is like, how do you feel about that in terms of as the homebrew community and, you know, maybe a different audience or a different kind of way to present your ideas compared to more mainstream or indie games that might be on like a different platform? I mean, is there any kind of like thing that just to begin with you really like to do that is you think unique to the homebrew scene?
Yeah, so I think what you're saying initially there, like talking to Nick yesterday, I know I speak for the rest of the team that we appreciate the feedback, good and bad. And you guys do it in a very constructive way, and we appreciate that very much. So I understand that some people don't like to hear negative things about their games, like Nathan. But I feel like when it's done in a respectful way, we learn from it. This is what we were talking about yesterday. Like for developers, there's nothing better to learn from than people that will dig into the game, like you guys really dug in, and I feel really bad that you had to slog through all of that.
I did play the game for 35 hours.
That's crazy.
It's an NES game, and it's not an RPG, it's a platformer.
But yeah, so it's great to see that, and like I said, I feel bad when some people have to slog through it just to get to do like an interview or whatever, but I do feel like most people at least get a chance to appreciate some facets of the game, right? So there's something good you can take from it, the good with the bad. So that's really nice to see, and it's really like heartwarming to get good feedback, but then it's also very educational to get the negative or the neutral feedback. Even though you can't go back and change things, you know, we want to keep doing this. This isn't like a one-off for us. We want to keep going in this NES community, maybe make the leap to Super Nintendo at some point. So we have to learn. We have to grow as a team, you know, and as developers.
Yeah. Well, and I should say, so I had negative things to say about the game, but I was also very positive about the game. It is a massive, incredible achievement, Full Quiet. And I encourage everybody to at least check it out and listen to our podcast episode about it. And as far as negative things to say about other games, I can say with Nathan's last game, I had very many negative things to say about it because I was a beta tester on it, and I would go into that, but I am not supposed to swear today. So, but yeah.
In fact, none of us are supposed to swear today.
Yeah. I can't even show you what I wrote on my hand.
It's right. I know. Okay, so tell me, how did you guys originally get interested in making games for the NES?
initially, it was my business partner, Tim Hartman. He found chiptunes online, something that I didn't never even thought about, right? Like people ripping those from old games. And we were just looking for, always looking for new music. Him and I grew up playing music together. And he was just like, oh, check this stuff out.
We're not swearing. Is that it?
Okay.
No swearing.
Yeah, got it. Okay. I'm gonna have to work a little harder here then.
Yeah, boy, I'm right there with you.
Okay, so anyway, yeah. So he found chiptunes online, and that was, we were like, this is awesome. How is this being made? Like diving into that stuff, then found hacks of like Super Tecmo Bowl or something like that. And it was just like discovering that people were doing this stuff was really cool to see. And then of course, Nintendo Age. Once we found Nintendo Age, it was like, this is such a great community, and like everybody is super helpful here. And we just wanted to like dig in, like, how is this being done? Okay, what is assembly language? Like, none of us were coders, not until Damien came on the team, Tepples, Pino Batch. So we were just kind of trying to figure things out on our own. How do we make kind of art? What is a tile? What you know, like, what's a general size? What's a sprite? We come from a background of zero development, zero programming. So it was just neat for us to learn something new and be welcomed into the community like we were. So it was very, I guess I didn't quite expect it because I'm not a big online person. I've never like met people online and then met them in real life. And this was basically my first foray into anything like that. And it's been such an awesome experience getting to know people and learning about such interesting subject matter. Even though it's a 35-year-old machine, it's still just like what we really wanted, what we grew up with, and what we really wanted to just take a stab at making games for.
Yeah, and to be clear, what's the time frame that we're talking about? When was this that you guys got interested in development?
Like 2013, I think, is when Tim found chiptunes.
Okay.
And then over the course of like a year or so, we started digging in, and then 2014 started to make Haunted Halloween 85. Yes. We wanted to release it for the 30th anniversary of the NES hitting US shores in 2015. So we were just like, this is the deadline. We had the game mostly done, and we flew out to the Portland Retro Gaming Expo that year with like 30 copies of it. And we were like, this is just going to be a fun experience. You know, if nobody buys it, oh, well, we made something that we like that we think is pretty cool. And it was the opposite. Like I said, we met several other homebrewers out there, and they were like, oh, this is really cool that you guys are doing this. Just welcomed us into the community, and people like the game. And that was that. We were like, we're going to keep doing this, you know?
Yeah. I want to talk a little bit about Full Quiet. And before we get into that, I wanted to ask you about, so this... this idea of homebrew and versus like a retro indie games. What do you guys call them? You call them retro indies?
I've always called it homebrew.
Okay.
Tim calls it indie NES.
Indie NES. Yeah, we talked about that.
A little bit hard to say. I think indie like you guys NES. Brought that up on the podcast, right?
It sounds like a mnemonic or something.
Yeah. I don't really care what people call it. To me, it's just cool. So whatever, you know, whatever people are interested in calling it, it doesn't really bother me. I think the term homebrew is kind of cool. Also, it's kind of like there's beer homebrew, which I also like, maybe a little too much. So I'm fine with that.
Well, and your games, too, are not... You guys have really expanded beyond just distributing on the actual NES. Like, your games are all over the place. Like, I can get Full Quiet or Haunted Halloween games or Mad Mike. I can get those on any platform. You can get them on Steam or Switch or...
Yeah, that's something we've really been working towards, is getting the game on multiple platforms. The porting process is very difficult, it's something cool to like learn, and we like doing things for ourselves as much as we can. So it's been a cool process. We've been doing that through 8-Bit Legit, is what we've been calling our publishing label thing. So it's just a good way to help our friends get their games onto Switch, onto Xbox. We're working on PlayStation. That is a nightmare. It's like, it's a struggle, but it's cool, and we're trying to get the games out to the people where they're at, you know, meet them where they are.
I just want to point out the incredible irony of a system that is 35 years old being easier to publish games for than a modern system. Yeah. I think that's something that maybe is not appreciated very much by people who are not developers, but like, there's kind of this understanding like, oh, well, if I can download it over the internet, it must be easier to publish the game there. It must be easy to get your game on a system that lets you download over the internet if it's a physical cartridge. But sometimes it's equivalent, if not more difficult, effort.
Yeah, so one of the things that's also ironic in that regard is we're working on a PlayStation port currently, and the game is just getting bogged down because the console can't handle what's going on under the hood.
That blows my mind.
Which, right, makes no sense, right?
I love it. Absolutely love it.
Emulation, it can be taxing on a system. So we're trying to find ways to optimize. It's basically like the PS5 can do it, but the PS4 and the PS4 Pro can't.
That is hilarious.
Right. Crazy. Hilariously frustrating.
Yo, yeah. Oh, sorry. I want to emphasize that. As the developer, I bet the joke stopped being funny a long time ago. But for me, as somebody who plays the games, knowing that the PlayStation 4 is literally like 1,000 to 10,000 times faster in terms of all of its capabilities, like graphically, blah, 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 maybe more. Like literally millions of times the amount of space to store the game. I understand also at the same time from my own background why that is difficult and why it's difficult to get that emulation like frame perfect on those systems. So I know for a fact that that is the case, that it's not something that's unique to your game. It's actually just an inherent limitation of the system.
Yeah. It pretty much doesn't matter what game it's running. Now, with a game like Full Quiet, because we try to push the limits of the console so much, we can't like cut certain parts of the emulation out to reduce the footprint. So it's just a struggle, but it's like I said, it's fun, it's interesting, and you know, hopefully we can just continue to get more NES games out there where people are.
Yeah, I want to emphasize that for people who are maybe coming into Homebrew for the first time, thinking, oh, that this must be like limited in terms of what it can display compared to a PlayStation game. Like, no, you can actually do a lot on an NES that then a PlayStation 4 finds difficult to reproduce. So I just think that's really, really interesting to share.
Yeah, something I wanted to ask about marketing and distribution of these retro games on modern consoles. Because, you know, you're competing with stuff like, you know, for example, Shovel Knight, that is a modern game that just, you know, apes the look of a retro game. It's inspired by pixel art, but it's, you know, it doesn't have the same limitations that an actual NES game would. And so when you put something on like the eShop or Steam, you're competing against games that don't have those restrictions. And so like what kind of considerations do you make when you put something out there that, you know, you're going to be in that kind of spot where you're competing with stuff like that?
Yeah, that's a question. I think that, and definitely when we first released Haunted Halloween 85, the number one thing that it was compared to with people at conventions was Shovel Knight. And they're like, well, Shovel Knight does this. And we're like, oh, come on. I mean, like, Shovel Knight's such a great game. We know this. It kicks ass. But like you're saying, there's just certain things we can't do on there. And people weren't being disrespectful, but they just weren't familiar with the limitations of the NES. And like, why can't you have real parallaxing? Like, why you don't have multiple background layers, so you just can't do it. The amount of colors that are on screen at any one given time, just things that people aren't familiar with. But definitely it was like, at first we were kind of getting frustrated because it was people, they weren't trying to criticize the game, but they were just like, why can't you do this, which was cool to see the interest, but a little bit frustrating because we were like, man, we're never going to live up to what Shovel Knight does. You know, we're just never going to be able to do that kind of thing. And that's fine. We've just kind of learned to work around it, which is part of what we love about this, is just finding ways to innovate and do new things with the NES.
And really briefly to add to that here, I think it's been really interesting, as this is my first MGC, to see the amount of floor space dedicated to the history of consoles and helping people understand more about that. Because I think it is really important to understand where these limitations come from, why they're there. And I've seen just a really like high level of engagement amongst all the people on the floor who really want to learn about this and see this and understand where this all came from, because it helps them respect and I think understand and appreciate these games more, just independently of seeing your game on a demo stand.
Yeah, we definitely saw that on the floor yesterday, people asking these very same questions, you know, like what are some of the limitations that you had to work around, and like, why don't All Was Awakening and things like that. They're just gorgeous games. Now that one obviously works on the NES, but like the original one before they brought on Brad, it's there's just certain things that they were doing, even in like the UI, like the interface stuff, that makes the experience so much better for the player that we weren't even thinking about when we were making these games. Now that we're going through this like porting process, we're thinking about ways to add another layer to the experience to like make it a little more friendly for the modern player that doesn't understand like why we can't have certain things on there, like why there's not these huge menu systems and all these flashing lights and everything that people like. So yeah, it's just part of the, part of the learning process, part of the porting process that we get a little bit tripped up on, but it's just to try to make the experience overall better for the player and help them understand, like you were saying, what are some of the things that can be done and what are some of the things that we can work around with modern technology to help make the experience better.
Yeah, so like I wasn't on the podcast episode talking about your game because I got extremely busy at the beginning of the year and I just didn't have the time to put into it, but I did buy the cartridge. I have played it for quite a bit. There's a lot of stuff that I love about it. But one of the questions that I had for you is about, like, this is honestly the first new cartridge I've bought. I've been mostly working on, like, off of ROMs. And so, like, as far as, like, how you expect your players to play the game, like, you know, I would have loved to have been able to get the ROM to play it, especially considering I didn't get to put all that time into it to get onto the podcast. But don't get me wrong, I love owning the game because it is a gorgeous cartridge, gorgeous box. Like I love the green of the cartridge and it's just great. But like when you think about like how are you wanting your players to play the game? Is it like emulators or do you want them to buy the physical cartridge? Do you want them to play on the original hardware? Because that also begs the question about save states and you know stuff like that.
Yeah, that's what I was just going to bring up. So the main concern we had about people playing the ROM and using an emulator was save states. One of our play testers didn't listen to my request when I said no save states and also don't talk to your friends about it. I want the information. So anyway, so this is not Nathan, by the way. This is Bo. But anyway, so it was like, yeah, just don't use a save state so you go through because it's going to change the way, it's going to change your approach to the game if you're using save states. And
an argument I make.
And we said, like, you'll end up getting lost in a zoo of save states and you won't be able to remember what's in each save state, what you've done. And then you'll end up reporting bugs that aren't really bugs. And then it's going to take hours of our lives to try to hunt down a bug that wasn't actually there, that was just a mistake because you were between save states or something like that. So anyway, that's one of the main things, one of the main reasons we didn't want people to use emulation. I don't personally have an opinion about using them or not, what console people want to play it on or not. I think most, from the feedback I'm getting, Switch seems to be the one that people like the most because you can play the game for 20 minutes or half an hour. You're thinking about something, you know, when you're laying in bed or whatever, like, oh, maybe this is how I could solve that one thing. You could just pull out the Switch and give it a shot, you know. So I feel like that's probably the most preferable way to play the game. But we do plan on releasing the ROM soon, and we'll just put a disclaimer on there, like, you know, use save states with caution.
That's great. So we only have 10 minutes left, and I wanted to give everybody else a chance to ask Greg a question if you'd like to. Anybody have any questions? Sure, Nate.
Hello, I have a question. What I was saying, with Atari Age, you know, it's a very centralized location to learn about homebrews, to buy homebrews, all that. The NES doesn't really have anything like, or doesn't anymore. Do you find that sometimes that's a hindrance for discovery in homebrew? This is towards any of you if you want to answer that, but that's just something that always runs through my mind. Is that sometimes I'll learn about an NES homebrew game that's actually existed for years and I never knew about it because there weren't the same avenues of discovery. And I wonder if sometimes that can be a hindrance. Or if you prefer it that way.
Or for distribution, I guess I would say.
Yeah, so I think in general, the diversity is better. I know it can be annoying, and like I didn't even hear about Storied Sword. I just kind of, the Kickstarter for it, I just stumbled upon it. It was just dumb luck that I happened to see it. So that definitely happens where you don't get information that you would otherwise think you would get if everything was consolidated. But with things being sort of divided up in different groups, I feel like you get different kinds of innovation, different people working on different ideas. So in my mind, I feel like it's a little bit better, but I can understand that it would be frustrating that it's not all consolidated into one place. I know that my first foray into homebrew was through Nerdy Nights, which is no longer out there. I don't think so. It's on
NES.
Okay, good. Yeah. So that was what I always told people to go to. But when Nintendo Age got whatever consumed, taken down, it vanished. And so now I don't know where to tell people to go specifically. Obviously, there's like a Nestmaker community that's a great place to get into it. Very welcoming community. And then there's the NestDev forum, the Discord, just tons of places that you can go to learn this stuff. And I guess I understand that it can be frustrating that it's not all consolidated, but in general, I think it just makes for a more diverse community if there's a bunch of different places that things are happening.
Yeah. I would love to go on about Full Quiet for another couple of hours. I have a lot of questions for you about it.
Don't torture yourself.
but we need to wrap up and let the other folks coming on next get set up. So I want to thank you, Greg Caldwell, for coming up here today and talking to everybody.
Thank you guys for having me. This is very cool. I love what you guys are doing here. And I love what you guys do for the community. I can't say enough about how much it helps all of us that you guys take the time to do this stuff.
Oh, well, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Appreciate that. Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, we are going to wrap up here. Before we do, does anybody have any questions for us?
Yes, questions for us.
Questions. Yes. Does anybody want a 2XL shirt? Anybody?
Nobody wants a 2XL shirt.
It's
right
shirt.
Here, I'm telling you.
Just want one just for that.
Nobody wants the results
of that. All right. This has been the Homebrew Game Club podcast. You can find links to our... You know, I didn't ask you, where should we go to look at your stuff?
Oh, yeah, Greg. Retrotainment Games.
Retrotainmentgames.com. Thank you. This has been the Homebrew Game Club podcast. You can find links to our Discord, previous episodes of our show, or other social media links at homebrewgameclub.com. And you can look for us on your social media app of choice at HB Game Club. If you like the show, please help us out by leaving us a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. We'll be telling all of your retro gaming friends about our podcast. If you have comments or a suggestion for a game that you would like to hear us talk about, shoot us a message on social media or email us at homebrewgameclub@gmail.com. Or you can talk to us. We have a little station in the Nintendo Age room, video game stage room. It's on the second floor. It's all the way over there. And we are in there with a bunch of other really cool, brand new NES games that you can try out. And
today.
At least one Atari game. Yes. Our opening music. We don't have any opening music. I just start reading from the script.
We should just sing whatever. The theme music.
I will say our outro music is by Raftronaut. You can find its developer page at raftronaut.itch.io. You can find me, Nick, on your favorite social media apps as DVertov. That's DVERTOV. Bart is on Instagram as Clever Username Needed, no spaces. And Connor is on various social media at Connor Nash, CONORNASH, also no spaces. And please check us out on your favorite podcasting app of choice. Subscribe. Our next couple of games are Flea and Tapeworm Disco Puzzle for the NES and the Dreamcast. And they're a lot of fun. And we will
look forward to playing it with you over the next... Well, when's that episode going to come out? When's that episode going to come out?
It's going to come out sometime in April. Yeah. I don't know, man. All I've been thinking about is this and the Storied Sword. So, yeah. Thank you, everybody, for coming today.
Thank you.
It's been a lot of fun, and I'm sorry you didn't get to see Bart take his shirt off. I was really hoping we got to that one. Thank you.